Succession number 27083, reel 23.
Faced with laughs in the background.
Yes, and they were obviously deliberately setting out to disrupt things. Well, two can play that game, so I stopped my lecture and, looking directly at them, said things like, there are too many people speaking here, we'll have only one in the future. Either you keep quiet or you won't be shown the film, that'll be that. And I started off again, and quite quickly up they started all the frolicking. So I stopped, and I glared at them and said, right, you lot, out. And they started by trying not to do anything about it. But actually, the others then took over and said, come on, we want to see the film, sort of thing. And so, with tails between their legs, they left. And after that, it was all right. And we went on. And I completed the contract. And when it was over, still no sign of any member of the staff, let alone the headmaster. I went out to my car, which was a soft-top tourer sort of thing. And I found that in the dust, and there was a lot of it, the car was not clean, there were gross obscenities scribbled in the dust on the sides of the car. They'd skewed the headlamps, they'd torn off the cover, they'd done everything. So we piled the gear into the back of the car, and I drove round to the front of the school, to the headmaster's house. And stumped into his outer office where his secretary sat and said, asked if the headmaster was in. Yes, I was told, but he has a parent with him. And I said, well, will you tell him that I wish to speak to him at once, or shall I just go in? Oh, no, she couldn't do that. So without knocking, I threatened the door and walked in. And there were a couple of nondescript parents talking to the headmaster. Who remained seated behind his desk, and I strode up to the front of his desk. I told him exactly what I thought of him at his school and whose fault I considered it to be, and I stumped out, and that was there. And I was just in time to go up then. This was one of the few poaches I made, the Bishop's Stortford College, which was a perfectly nice, I think, second 11 public school. And there I was met almost on the doorstep by a charming headmaster and taken to his study and given a cup of coffee and generally looked after in a civilized way. And over a cup of coffee, I really couldn't help it. By this time I was, I simmered down a bit. I had been pretty cross. And I said straight out to him, what a pleasure it was to come to a decent school. Because rather like when you cross the gangway of a ship, you can pick up a few, and you're very seldom wrong. And I picked up a good feel about Bishop's Stortford College. And he was onto it quite quickly, and he said, really? Where have you just come from? And I said, secondary modern down the town. Oh, yes, he said, and what happened there? And I told him, and I didn't mince my words. And there was a slight pause, and he was a great big man, and he looked rather down at me. And he said, that's interesting. You see, I'm chairman of the Board of Governors. And that set me back a bit, and I said, well, sir, maybe I ought to apologize for having burdened you with this saga of woe. But I won't. I will say quite the reverse. I'm extremely glad I've had the opportunity to represent the facts of life to you. And that was that. So that was a complete obverse of how things could go very badly wrong,
yes,
and so on, which was interesting. And you never really knew until you got there. There was one sea cadet unit that I went to in the evening in Luton, I think it was. Quite a big unit. And the CO was a lieutenant commander. He was fat, he was scruffy, and the feel you picked up was this is a poor unit. And when it came to prayers, which was the usual opening gambit, various people had come up to report to him. He had his cap flatter back on his head. He was still smoking a cigarette. He was still smoking a cigarette with his cap on when he conducted prayers, and so on. And when I got back to Whale Island, eventually, I reported this via the system to Sea Cadet Headquarters. And the chap got an MBE 6 months later. So it was interesting. But again, that's all slightly off tune. I'm looking now at what I haven't, how far I've got. Oh, yes. At that time, there was a thing known as initiative tests. And it was, and I'm back to Whale Island now. It went, I don't know how far, how widespread it was, but it certainly occurred in the Portsmouth area. And the Portsmouth area contained at the time really all the subspecialist schools. I don't think it applied terribly much to the Home Fleet or any other fleet, but anyway. I've already mentioned that there was intense rivalry between Excellent and Vernon, gunnery and torpedoes and so forth. All good friendly stuff, but there was intense rivalry. I had, when I was parade training officer previously, the captain of Vernon had asked for a really first class chief gunnery instructor to be drafted to Vernon to shake it up. The captain of Vernon at the time was a man called Hughes Hallett, otherwise known as Hughes Hitler, and so on. And he was, quite rightly and justifiably, he was fairly dissatisfied. And I sent, I'd mentioned him before, I sent Tex Burrell, one of my chief GIs, who was a remarkable man. Didn't care what he said, the man or beast. The epitome of smartness himself, and it was fine. When he got to Vernon, he, quite rightly, I think, started at the top, and he started on the officers, and that meant the staff, because they were sloppy, and they were bad at saluting, and they were bad at returning salutes, and a button undone, or generally slipshod. And Burrell was only there for 6 months or so. But again, the captain of Vernon got on to the captain of Whaley and said he was deeply grateful for the services of Burrell, who was doing a simply splendid job, but he thought he really would have to return him because he, the captain of Vernon, was seriously afraid that he would go one step too far and there would be a scene which would do Burrell himself no good at all. So he came back to Whaley. Well, that's slightly outside initiative tests, but the initiative test that I'm about to describe to you occurred between Whaley and Vernon. And I don't know why this, what triggered this off, it doesn't matter. It was on, and it was planned that a particular gunnery officer, a chap called Fred Munden, who was a personal friend of mine, and he was ex-low deck and quite a tough cookie. He was a lieutenant commander, and he was going to dress up as a pusser, a paymaster, and go with an escort in sidearms and women equipment and so forth, and a special lockable carrier bag, and he was going to invade the cash office at Vernon and take away a token bit of cash. Of course, it would have been returned and so on. And he did this, and he was driven down in a passer's van with his escort, armed escort for carrying money and all that stuff, petty officer plus two, he didn't really know where the pay office was. You may say he should have done a recce, but anyway, he didn't really know where the pay office was. And at the gate of Vernon, where they had a security staff, he merely stuck his head out the window and said, which way to the cash office? I've come to collect the cash. And they pointed out the way to the cash office. And it involved him going through the whole length of a Nissen hut. And the cash office was at the end. and there was nothing on the entrance to the Nissen hut because the security stopped at the gate, as it were. And so with caps on and escort and all the rest of it, he strode into the through the Nissen hut into the cash office at the other end. And there was the cash officer, who was some unfortunate ex-low deck passer lieutenant also, with the safe wide open, and so on. And he said, this is an exercise hold-up. I'm going to take a token bundle of cash, and you are not to do anything about it for 2 minutes after I have left your office. Is that quite clear? And the chap was rather sort of rude and nervous. And he picked up a bundle of cash, and rather more quickly they strode back down the length of Nissen Hut. And the telephone was ringing on the gate when they went out through it. And that was that. So he got away with that run. And the commander-in-chief Portsmouth at the time, as he then called himself, was Arthur John Power, himself a gunnery officer, and a fairly black and white one, to say the least. And, of course, he knew about this. Indeed, I think it had to be reported to the commander-in-chief what you had done or what the result of your initiative test had been. Anyway, it got to the commander-in-chief. And this had occurred on, say, a Thursday morning or afternoon, I forget which. And the captain of Whaley was a man called... wait a moment. It'll come to me. He rose to be a vice-admiral. Elkins. Bob Elkins, Robert Elkins. Charming man with a very charming wife, who eventually went over and was our man in Washington, where his wife, who, by the most flattering account, could best be described as tweedy, she was a very nice woman, and everybody thought, you know, how on earth is she going to get on amongst the sheik of Washington, D.C.? And they loved her. They fell about over how beautiful she was and that sort of thing. She was still always dressed in tweeds. Anyway, he was the captain of Whaley, and he got in a panic, and he was determined that Vernon would attempt to kidnap him. And so he had sentries placed on his front and his back doors, and he didn't attempt to enter the mess for a drink before dinner or anything like that. And it was all very, very tense stuff. And up came the CNC, who by this time, and there had been other incidents of which I'm unaware, said, and it was a very carefully worded signal. He was quite a shrewd officer. And he said that the business of initiative tests was to cease as at midnight on, and it was about 48 hours later. and it gave Vernon time to do something in retaliation, but not too much time. And they retaliated. And what they did was that at about 2 o'clock in the morning, a picket boat arrived at the pierhead in Whale Island. out of it stepped a man dressed as a surgeon commander and a couple of sick berth attendants carrying a stretcher and so forth. And the pierhead was manned by one petty officer only. And very peremptorily, the surgeon commander, who of course wasn't, said, where's the accident? The pierhead petty officer didn't know of any accident, not least because there hadn't been one, and so forth. So even more peremptorily, the bogus surgeon commander said, which is the direction of your experimental department? And of course, the layout of Whaley was easily discernible in advance. But he wasn't quite sure which way to go, and it was pitch dark and so forth. And he got there. And they broke into the experimental department, and they took away some not very important book of records or something, and so forth. And that was that. And it was the end of the initiative tests. So that was a mixture, really, of work and fun. And it was quite interesting.
If I may interrupt, just to help me pick things from time to time. One served 8 years as a lieutenant, and I've just done a calculation. You should now be a lieutenant commander.
I wasn't quite.
Because now in 52, and in the autumn of 43, you were made a lieutenant, and you should now, I would have thought, wasn't.
Well, I may have got a year out somewhere. The 8 years is definite. That's what you did, flat, as a lieutenant. I shipped a half stripe during, halfway through the staff course, which I'm coming on to next. And that would have been, that was in 52, actually.
Yes.
You're quite right. And the length of the staff course, as I shall mention later, are we being recorded now?
Yes.
Was then, for the naval staff course, was only 6 months.
Right.
Whereas the army staff course was, I think, 18 months, but they included what we called our tactical course as well. And the Air Force was somewhere in between at about 9 months. I mentioned earlier that we, on the long course, we went to Lark Hill, and it was customary for the two long course equivalents to visit each other once during their time on course. And for the next visit of the Army instructors in gunnery course, as they called it, IGs, I was put in charge of them as liaison officer. And the form, whichever end it was, took a fairly standard pattern, ending, as I mentioned earlier, I think, with a pretty formidable guest night on the penultimate night, the Thursday night. And when they came to Whale Island, whoever had won the series of sporting and other competitions was supposed to calibrate a thing called the Golden Gun, and I can show you a replica in my hall now. And it was fed with 12-bore cartridges, and you balanced a billiard ball on the muzzle, and it came out with quite some oomph, and so on. That was fine. They came down, and being in charge of them, one had to organize the extramural activities to make sure that they were up to snuff. One of the other things that they were always subjected to was a thing called the field gun run. And the main anteroom, collectively referred to as the sub-lieutenant's anteroom, because that's where they all gather, and they were the lifeblood of the island, really, was a huge barn-like structure at Frehley. And it had a bar at one end and two doors at the other, and a couple of doors on the side to go out in the passage and that sort of thing. And this event always occurred after dinner, well after dinner. And the field gun drill was bedstead drill, and a perfectly ordinary iron hospital bed with no trappings on. So it was just the bed head and the tailboard and the springs in the middle. You split up into two teams, and each team had to produce a corpse who lay face down on the springs. And to get the bedsteads through the doorways, you had to dismantle, just like the field gun is dismantled, and take the main spring frame off from the bed head and the foot of the bed in order to get through the doorway, and so on. And when you we had a straight run down the length of this quite long barn-like structure, and everybody cheered like mad, and the chances were, subject to delays in getting through the doorways at the end, that you met more or less in the middle of the staff anteroom, which was a much smaller room, and of course you were coming in opposite directions, and so you met going in opposite directions in this smaller anteroom. And the spectators stood back in the smaller anteroom and lobbed in thunder flashes. This was quite an interesting melee, to say the least. And why nobody got seriously hurt, I can't imagine, but they didn't often. Well, we did all that. And the other thing that the army really boasted about was, and I thought it was a rather unpleasant competition, and it was called beer drinking. And it took the form of each team stood on either side of a long table, and opposite each chap was a pint of beer. And you started with the lead men, and the number twos were not allowed even to pick up their glasses until the number ones had completed and put them down, and so forth. And I thought this was really rather bestial as an occupation, because I can't drink beer fast. But of course, some lusty soldiers can pretty well pour it down their throats. And so I devised an alternative. And I went round the Portsmouth chemists, and I got all I needed. And I got the requisite quantity of baby's bottles. I had a little more difficulty in getting the requisite quantity of teats, but I did. And that was that. And I borrowed our VAD's uniform, and when this event was coming up, I put on the uniform and lined them up. And there they were, you know, the soldiers were stripping off their tunics and their mess kit, and then they're sort of flexing their muscles. And so forth, and how they poured it down, and blah, 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 and everyone does, everyone. And in came VAD Leach with a sort of wicker basket full of filled baby's bottles, filled with beer. With teats on them, yeah. Well, they got about halfway down, and I forget who started it off first, and somebody thought of the bright idea of pulling a teat off, and then somebody else thought of pulling both teats off. And there were a couple of soldiers who didn't pull any teats off. And so, and there it was, all a bit of fun, but it was quite entertaining. And the other thing I was put in charge of was a sort of annual tournament. Known as Brickwood Day, because it was sponsored by the brewery, Brickwood. And at Brickwood Day, there were all sorts of turns, including runs of our own field gun as if it had been Olympia or Earth Court. And so there was a field gun run between the sub-lieutenants, etc., etc. And there were other incidents. And one of the incidents when I was put in charge of it, which I had not concocted, was a sort of oldie-worldie thing whereby a number of officers dressed up in old-fashioned rig, and they manipulated a cannon, and it was a real cannon, that onto the parade ground. And they gave loud shouts of prepare your gun for action and all that sort of stuff. And the idea was that you would stuff down the muzzle a small charge and a wooden cannonball, because otherwise it was too dangerous, would emerge and go a short distance, cricket pitch or so. But it would be more realistic. It would make quite a loud bang. For the event, around the perimeter of the parade ground were huge wooden stands, which were they were permanently made, but they were stored elsewhere for the rest of the year, and so on. Through which, at the far end, there was a gap of about the width of this room, and these stands were usually packed, partly by ordinary spectators, partly by officers and sailors still to come on and do their turn, or resting after having just done one, and so on. And one of the things I organized was that my gunnery instructors qualifying should be drawn up in two lines, and they should fix bayonets, all very immaculate drill stuff, and they should charge. And they should charge at each other with bayonets fixed and rifles at the long point and pass through their respective ranks. And somebody remarked to me, I said, is this going to work, sir? Is this going to be safe? And I said, I don't know whether it's safe or not, but it's up to you to make it work. They didn't like that much, but so it did work. Whereas the old-fashioned cannon demonstration at the dress rehearsal did not work, and there was only a very minor sort of puff instead of an explosion, and the wooden cannonball literally dribbled out of the muzzle of the gun and trickled about
5 yards.
Well, if that's 5 feet almost. At which point I sent for the gunner in charge of the ammunition section, who had provided this charge. And he was a very dour man. We weren't great friends. And I'd had slight trouble with him before. And this tipped him over the edge. And he left me with very bad grace. I said, you know, you've got to do better than this, because everybody's watching, even the CNC may come, and that sort of thing. And so on. And on the day, all went well, and I controlled things from the top of a nearby air raid shelter, and I showed various discs saying stand by and go and so forth. So it was all, dare I say, it was quite slickly done. And the time came for this event, and it all started off all right. Prepare your gun for action. And the taper was put to the touch hole, and there was an enormous explosion, and you could see sort of smoke and crap and corruption coming out of the muzzle of this piece, and there was a ghastly sort of clang as the cannonball ricocheted off one of the stands forming the gap, and a slight pause, and in the distance, a faint tinkle of glass. And shortly afterwards, I must say, I was faintly upset about this, because it went through with some vigor. And the stands, of course, were, beyond the day, were fully manned. And all the sailors were sort of looking down between their legs and wondering what. And then a little man, I can remember his name, he was a warrant ordnance officer, a delightful little man, called him probably Mr. Turgoose. And he had been taking a class in the ordnance section in one of the huts further down towards the pier head. And in the middle of his lecture, a cannonball had broken through the window, ricocheted halfway round the room, scared the living daylights out of all hands, and he brought with him what was left of the wooden cannonball. And there we were. So that was, I haven't actually counted that as one of my lies, but it came very close to being so. I think I've said enough about all that. I had a very happy 2 years there. And I had asked to do this because I'd asked to do the naval staff course. And I did so because I firmly believed, and I was then a senior lieutenant, and I believed that if you waited until you were a senior lieutenant commander, still less a commander, that really you'd had so much experience behind you that the need for a staff course had largely lapsed. You would be less susceptible to changing your ways if they were the wrong ways.